did. We all did. But that's the shit that I need to work on. And that's what I was relating to the most in Mike's story. Trying to be a better human being. Tyson's honesty is what I respected the most. He's always unapologetic and honest to a fault at times. Tyson spoke to Matt Lauer in an interview and told him, "If I'm drinking, I think about suicide." Tyson was talking about suicidal thoughts like I talk about wanting to have an egg salad sandwich. They brought Mike to a sober living conference, and the first thing out of his mouth was, "I've been lying to everyone here about being sober. I'm a vicious alcoholic, and I haven't stopped drinking." They brought him in to talk about the benefits of being sober, and he told them that he was drunk. Fucking crazy. Honesty. Flawed motherfucking honesty. I wish I could be that raw. I want to be that raw. I want to admit to my demons way more than I do. Mike told Lauer in that same interview, "I hate myself. You know, I try to kill myself every day." Here's the former heavyweight champion of the world saying he wants to kill himself every day. Mike put a finger to his temple and he said, "You know, it's hard to live up here. No one's seen what I've seen. None of these fighters, none of these athletes. I'm the king of barbarians. I'm a monster." Yo, Mike Tyson, you're not a monster. You're just a flawed motherfucker like the rest of us. So thank you for being brave and ballsy, do your one-man show. And thank you for letting me know that if the former baddest man on the planet could start humbling himself and trying to find inner peace, a loudmouth punk like me could start trying too. This chapter was written before Floyd Mayweather fought Conor McGregor. For the record, I was 500% behind Floyd Mayweather kicking Conor McGregor's ass, and I was super fucking happy when he did. The Conor McGregor rant will be coming soon to a theater near you, but this is about Floyd Mayweather, who's great in the ring and shitty in life. Floyd Mayweather is amazing in boxing and a prick in life, and I mean that from the bottom of my heart. Floyd, you're a fucking jackass. I don't care that your footwork is second to none and that you made Canelo Alvarez look like an amateur when you fought him. And I don't care that you took Manny Pacquiao apart like he was thinking about being president of the Philippines the entire time. It doesn't bother me that your counter-punching might be the best in the game and that no one can touch you with your peekaboo-style defense. I get it. You've mastered boxing, Floyd. But you act like a fucking clown. You throw money in the air at strip clubs and you hit women. Kids everywhere are watching you saying, "If I make Floyd's money, I could buy a Bentley, throw money on a thick, fat-ass stripper, and beat up a girl." Wake the fuck up, Floyd. It's not too late. I know you don't want to be a role model, but you are. Yeah, man, that's the way the world works. You play a sport, you become the best, you make millions, and people look up to you. I don't make the rules, assweather. So stop riding around your house on a Segway chasing 50 Cent around like a girl trying to get an autograph. And get your life straight. Look, I want to talk to you just one-on-one, just me and you. We get in a room, we sit down like gentlemen, and we get into that fucked up head of yours. Just give me 10 minutes. Look, I know life wasn't easy for you growing up. The abuse you went through, the poor upbringing, and the family full of fighters. I get it. Life isn't fair, but we could talk it all out, Floyd. The problem is I know how the conversation is going to go. Yo, man, thanks for sitting down with me, Floyd.
Yo, Rappaport, you see my Instagram where I took a shit on a pile of money?
No, I didn't see that.
Yo, I shit on $2 million cash.
Well, what's with the women beating, Floyd? Where did all that come from? Look, I know you came from a tough, fucked up background, but come on, man.
Yo, Rappaport, yo, this watch is worth $500,000. I push a button, and the shit calls a helicopter.
You're avoiding everything, Floyd.
What do you want to know, motherfucker?
I want to know how one of the greatest fighters ever to get in the ring can be so fucked up in life.
Yo, I bought 200 pairs of red Yeezys.
Yo, fuck this. I don't like you, Floyd, and I really want to like you. I was sitting on the edge of my seat watching you and Manny Pacquiao go toe-to-toe, and I was praying Manny was going to take your fucking head off. I was yelling, "Come on, Manny, where's the footwork, the angles, and those heavy hands? Come on, Manny, kill the body, and the head will fall. Manny, what the hell? What the fuck, Manny? You can't be that into running for political office." And I got nothing. Manny gave me nothing. Then I had to go back and rewatch your first fight with Marcos Maidana because I just knew I was seeing a guy coming at you like a tank and landing blows. So I went back and I watched the fight. And you know what, Floyd? You little bling bling beat a girl fake drinking club loving degenerate gambler. He didn't land one blow on you. This motherfucker had the entire world thinking there was a way to beat Floyd Mayweather and the guy didn't touch you. You leaned back with that half flat-footed defense hiding in your clavicle and then you moved a centimeter left and a centimeter right and Maidana didn't do a thing. You got my head all fucked up, Floyd, but I still had hope that someone was going to kick your ass. So here comes Canelo Alvarez. He's going to come in and he's going to show you what the youth of America looks like. You want to play with Instagram, Floyd? Here's a kid that grew up on that shit. And he knows Snapchat too, and he's coming in like a redheaded fire engine ready to put your bitch-made fire out. And then you did it again. I was yelling, come on, Canelo, do something. You're twice his size. You're 8 years younger. Plus, you're redheaded. And everyone knows that redheads got that anger shit in their DNA. I never met a calm redhead in my life. Even the redheaded women that I know are angry. It's something in the orange. I don't know. I have no idea. I'm not a scientist. Now here comes Canelo looking like a ripped version of Malachi from Children of the Corn, who, by the way, I was in acting class with in 1989. Every scene that guy Courtney Gaines did was about torture. Anyway, I wanted Canelo to whoop your ass so bad. Then the opening bell rang, and Canelo Alvarez second-guessed his entire career. This is supposed to be the super kid. This is the kid that's going to prove to the world that Floyd Mayweather is beatable. And you stood back, pawed the jab, snapped it when you had to, then smiled and landed a left hook to the ribs as if it was a punchline to a joke. Fuck you, Floyd. Canelo telegraphed the right hand so badly you got a haircut before it landed. Kiss my ass, Floyd. Fuck you for being so great in the ring and so shitty in life. But just sit with me for 1 minute, man. I know I could help you. Floyd, you think you would have walked through guys like Marvin Hagler?
Yo, you ever see sunglasses with diamond-encrusted rims?
All right, Floyd, if you fought Tommy Hearns, who is 6'3", 147 pounds with that reach and the best right hand in the game, you think you would win?
Yo, you see the new iPhone 11? That shit makes pizza just by asking. Yo, I got 200 of them.
Yo, fuck this. I'm gone. Floyd, I know I'm not going to get a chance to ever sit down and talk to you, but I'm going to give you some unwarranted, unwanted, unheeded advice. Clean your life game up, Floyd. Clean it up, man. There's no reason to throw money in the air on social media when motherfuckers are out here starving. There's no reason to post pictures of your gold Bentley when kids looking up to you might never have the means to get that car. Not to mention 7 out of 10 people that drive those shits are assholes. You flaunt shit in people's faces so badly that your own people robbed you and you ended up catching a case for kidnapping. Your own people, Floyd. You did 60 out of 90 days for domestic abuse and this wasn't your first offense. Floyd, get into some therapy, man. I don't care if you have to take a note from Russell Wilson's I Quit Pussy playbook. Give yourself a timeout, Floyd. There's still time. Make it happen. And if you want to, I'm here for you, man. Get at me. The great white hype of Ronda Rousey. Now let it be known that I don't hate Ronda Rousey. I like Ronda Rousey. I love what she did and I respect the hell out of the hard work she had to put into her sport. She's a well-trained, first-rate, disciplined athlete. She won a bronze at the 2008 Summer Olympics in Beijing, and that shit is very real. However, you people at the Business Insider magazine fucked up when you gave her the title, the most dominant athlete alive. I don't know what the fuck Business Insider is, and they seem like some clickbait bullshit, but what business are you actually inside of? Not the sports business. You put Ronda Rousey ahead of Serena Williams, LeBron James, Tom Brady, Usain Bolt, and a gang of other athletes that are still dominating to this day. Where the hell was your head? To me, this was a black eye on sports journalism. The most dominant athlete alive? She wouldn't even be the most dominant athlete in my neighborhood. Makiba Jonas was. I saw Makiba beat up 2 burnouts during lunchtime and walk back to class like nothing happened while she was smoking the cigarette she jacked off of them. She was dominant regardless of her age advantage due to her being left back twice. Ronda Rousey was knocked out by Holly Holm weeks after this article came out. The most dominant athlete alive was punched in the face and was not looking very dominant. It was upsetting, yes, but not an upset. Again, Ronda's personal story is great. It's heartwarming, it's authentic, and it's a true rags-to-riches story. She was homeless at one time in her life and truly became an iconic athlete in the new millennium. An inspiring narrative, absolutely. You know what else is a great story? The life and times of Amanda Nunes, an openly gay Brazilian chick who came from the bottom of the bottom of the favelas in Brazil to dismantle Ronda Rousey in 48 easy seconds. That, my friends, at the Business Insider, is real domination. Has Amanda Nunes appeared on any magazine cover since? Is she hobnobbing with Ellen DeGeneres? Is she swimming in any endorsement money? Fuck no. She's back at the gym trying to stay out of the Brazilian ghettos. Now, this isn't totally Ronda's fault. This is the media's bullshit buildup. This is the same shit they do in boxing when they get a decent-looking fighter with okay talent and they want to build up a star. I know the game, but the entire media buildup of Ronda Rousey was some classic great, white, and hopeful bullshit. And they took it too far, way too fast, and Ronda Rousey was the one who paid the price. The beatings that she took were, in my opinion, avoidable if they would have given her some time to train as opposed to worrying about her getting a photo shoot so she could help blow up your sport. So do me a favor and save terms like most dominant athlete alive for people like Steph Curry, Michael Phelps, or even that soccer ball kicker Lionel Messi. People that dominated for long periods of time. You can't be the most dominant anything at 11-0, and that was Rousey's record at the time the article came out. I was 19-0 in 7th grade slap boxing matches, and no one said shit about it. Did I have a 9-inch reach advantage because of a growth spurt no one saw coming? Yes, but I wasn't being heralded as the greatest of anything. So I'm begging you guys, you can't just keep giving titles like this away. I get it. I know you're building a product, but don't do it at the expense of cheapening your sport, endangering your athletes, and tricking the public. And as a side note, I know I wouldn't last 10 seconds in the ring with Ronda Rousey. I'm flat-footed, and I don't do well in tight spots. Anyone who puts me in a headlock, I fake my own sleep. And I don't blame you, Dana White, either. He doesn't write these pieces in these stupid magazines. His job is to sell tickets, and he's doing a great job at that. I like Dana White. Sure, we don't hang out much, but I do have his cell number, plus he's gotten me good tickets to MMA fights, and I hope he doesn't stop. So get at me, Dana, and good luck with the rest of your life, Ronda Rousey. Why boxers make more money than MMA fighters. I enjoy watching UFC and I want to see the sport grow. But I do think they need to figure out a couple of things fast. The way it's going, there will never be a UFC fighter making Floyd Mayweather money unless he's fighting Floyd Mayweather. You know why? Because there's too many ways to lose in MMA and shutter your career while it's on the rise. In MMA, you may be the best wrestler in the game, and then you get knocked out by a boxer, and the train stops. You may have the best stand-up game in the UFC, but then you didn't prepare for that ankle lock. You may be a better jiu-jitsu master, but you didn't see that judo coming. Fighters need momentum to build careers and make that big money. And in the UFC, it's too tough to build real momentum. Boxers generally have been doing one thing for much longer. Boxers usually start when they're about 7 years old. You fight in the amateurs and in tournaments every week. And you build your amateur record running around the country with your family in a van. Then, if you show any promise, you go international and you fight your way around the world. If you shine there, then you may fight in the Olympics. By that time, you've got about 60 or 70 amateur fights under your belt and you're only about 17 years old. Finally, when you get out of the Olympics, people know you. The world's been watching you and the promoters are circling. You've been building a fan base and millions of people have heard your name. Now Bob Arum, Don Goosen, or Don King and Lou DiBella want to sign you and build your pro career. But they won't rush you like the UFC did for Ronda Rousey. Mike Tyson was 22-0 before you ever saw his face on the cover of Sports Illustrated. Ronda Rousey was 11-0 already starring in movies and a magazine cover girl. The media also needs to stop comparing boxers and MMA fighters as being equals in the ring. It's ridiculous. Would a grappler who's trained in submissions and knows how to choke you out with your own shirt beat up a boxer in a street fight if he got him on the ground? Of course he would. But would a well-trained boxer dismantle any MMA fighter with limited boxing experience in an actual boxing match? Yes. And you know who never, ever makes these comparisons? Boxers and MMA fighters, because they know more than anybody that these are two different sports. Why the fuck are they even having these talks on TV and radio sports shows every single day? It's like wondering if Michael Phelps would beat Usain Bolt in NASCAR. They're both the fastest in their sports. How would 100 laps at the Indianapolis 500 turn out? Who gives a flying fuck? Shut this stupid conversation down once and for all. And I am begging, please don't let Floyd Mayweather fight Conor McGregor. If this stupid fucking fight actually happens, I may never order a boxing match again in my life. I will not pay my hard-earned money for that bullshit circus act fight. And Floyd, if you take that fight, shame on you for embarrassing the sport that made you rich and famous. Conor McGregor is a loudmouth tough guy who, oddly enough, stole his entire persona from Floyd Mayweather, who stole it from Muhammad Ali, who took his animated style from pro wrestler Gorgeous George. Listen, Conor is great at MMA, but don't get it twisted. He's not going to stand the chance at beating Floyd, Canelo, Triple G, Terrence Crawford, Manny Pacquiao, or any top 20 ranked boxer. So I hope by the time this soon-to-be best-selling book hits the shelves, this fight will have never happened. I mean, you saw what Floyd Mayweather did to Manny Pacquiao, and you saw what he did to Canelo. If that's not enough to let you know what he would do to basically an amateur boxer like Conor McGregor, then I don't know what to tell you. Again, I respect the shit out of MMA and UFC. I'm a fan, but chill the fuck out.
And once again, Conor is on that great white hype train, just like Ronda Rousey was.
Conor McGregor, if you fight Floyd Mayweather, you're going to get hurt. You might get hit so hard in the liver that your stupid leprechaun tattoo will fall off. And I have no idea if you have a stupid leprechaun tattoo, but that shit could happen. You've been warned.
Sports films. Rocky is great, but not the greatest. There's an ongoing debate regarding what the best sports film of all time is. It's a favorite topic for many people. It's a sports blogger's dream to discuss, and it's something anyone who loves sports and films has sat around and argued about for years. Usually the list looks something like this. Number 10, Field of Dreams. Number 9, Miracle. Number 8, Slapshot. Number 7, Bad News Bears. Number 6, All the Right Moves. Number 5, Caddyshack. Number 4, Friday Night Lights. Number 3, White Men Can't Jump. Number 2, Hoosiers. Number 1, Rocky. That's a damn good list of films, and most of them would make my top 10 as well. Every one of those films strikes a different chord. If I want gritty, I go with Hoosiers. If it's a sensitive Sunday, I'll throw in Field of Dreams. Or I could just watch Caddyshack or Slapshot and enjoy a good laugh. And of course, Miracle is always good for some inspiration. Of course, any list of mine will always have Rocky near the top. Rocky was a life-changing movie experience for me. I saw it 20 times in theaters when it came out in 1976, and I was only 6 years old. No bullshit. My sister took me to see it the first time, then I saw it 3 times with my mom, 5 times with my dad, and anyone else I could tag along with. I could tell you anything and everything there is about that movie. It's probably my favorite movie of all time. Just thinking about Rocky gets me up and out of the house any single day of the week. I'll also stand right by Rocky II as being a totally underappreciated, high-quality film with one of the most spine-chilling moments in film history. When Adrienne wakes up out of her coma and tells Rocky she wants him to do something for her, and Rocky says, "What's that?" And she tells him, "Win. Win." And then Mickey says, "What are we waiting for?" It rocked my fucking world and made me the best moment of any Rocky film ever. I'm actually having a hard time right now not doing push-ups for no reason this very second. Rocky III even has its magical moments. I mean, you can't go wrong with Mr. T's Clubber Lang. And don't even get me started on Burgess Meredith in all the films as Mickey. I will put him up there as one of the greatest characters ever to grace the screen in any genre of film. Even in Rocky IV, he had his one and only flashback scene where he says, "Get up, you son of a bitch, 'cause Mickey loves you." That moment was as inspirational as any TED Talk could ever dream of. That's the beauty of great sports films. They inspire. I mean, when I watch the Rudy movie, I still get emotional and cry against my will because it's so damn uplifting. Karate Kid is a dope sports film, and I'm not even sure if karate is a sport, but I'll be damned if I'm not waxing on and waxing off for hours after watching that great piece. The movie Major League, with pre-Tiger Blood winning Charlie Sheen, is amazing and still has a crazy cult following to this day. I mean, the list goes on, and if you wanted to, you could break them down into individual sports categories. North Dallas 40, Any Given Sunday, and the original Longest Yard go down to some of the best films made about football. Miracle and Slapshot are dope films about hockey. Field of Dreams and The Natural might take baseball, and fuck it, let's give Happy Gilmore and Tin Cup golf. I mean, Denzel Washington even has his own subcategory of great films he's made about sports. Hurricane, Remember the Titans, and He Got Game are all great films, and Denzel never disappoints. I don't care if you give him a basketball or an airplane while he's drinking, he's an acting beast. Muhammad Ali has his own section of great documentaries made about him. When We Were Kings, Soul Power, a.k.a. Cassius Clay, Muhammad and Larry, and The Thriller in Manila are all next-level fantastic documentaries made about the champ himself. ESPN's 30 for 30 series has made dozens of incredible top 10 worthy films. Winning Time, Reggie Miller vs. the New York Knicks, The Fab Five, Catching Hell, The Announcement, Survive in Advance are all worth watching as soon as possible. And I didn't even mention the sheer brilliance of When the Garden Was Eden, directed by maverick disruptive filmmaker Michael Rapaport. And the best of the entire bunch was O.J. Made in America, which just won the 2016 Oscar for Best Documentary. I mean, this list is never-ending, my friends. But none of these films that I just mentioned is the best. The best, my readership, is yet to come. And you're welcome. The best sports film of all time is Raging Bull. The Bronx Bull. The Raging Bull. Raging Bull is the greatest sports movie ever made. Not only is it the best sports movie ever made, it's the best film ever made. Strong statement? I think not. This masterpiece transcends the sports genre and stands alone as a cinematic endeavor by the master himself, Martin Scorsese. I'm sorry, Rocky Balboa. I really am. This hurt me more than it hurt you. Listen, I don't need to give you the obligatory description of what Raging Bull is about. If you haven't seen it, put this book down, crease the page right here, and go watch it and thank me later. But this is not an inspirational tale, and this is not a motivational tale. This is an in-depth story of one of the saddest, most complex characters of all time. The story is gut-wrenching. And what Martin Scorsese and Robert De Niro pulled off is nothing short of miraculous. There's no shiny lights, uplifting speeches, comebacks, or heroic moments in Raging Bull. Jake LaMotta, played by Robert De Niro, is an abusive, jealous, self-destructive motherfucker, and we love every single moment of it. All of Jake's flaws, vulnerabilities, and pain make him relatable and bring him to life like no character in any film I can think of. Listen. Raging Bull is not an easy film to watch, but it's not supposed to be. Life isn't easy to watch either, and no film mirrors life's depth of personal demons the way this masterpiece does. Raging Bull is my number one, folks, and I'm sticking by it. So these are my 15 rounds and reasons why Raging Bull isn't just the best sports movie ever made, but it's the best film ever made. Number one, Bobby De Niro. What hasn't been said about Robert De Niro's performance in Raging Bull? It's a game-changing moment in acting. De Niro took everything that had been done on film before and after him and brought it to a new plateau and a level we haven't seen since. It's the Big Bang moment in acting. You hear about method acting and living the part? Well, De Niro reached the method acting mountaintop and no one ever knocked him off. It's hard to argue what's best when it comes to art because it's also subjective, but this performance forced every actor and actress to rethink about what is possible
when it comes to creating a character. De Niro looked and moved like a professional boxer, then gained 60 pounds to play the out-of-shape LaMotta during his demise. The physical performance of Robert De Niro gave him the freedom to actually become Jake LaMotta. Every blink, every gesture, and every breath that Robert De Niro took as Jake LaMotta is a living organism and is as believable as anything we've ever seen on screen. He was in a zone you only see once in a lifetime. De Niro set the benchmark of what a person tries to achieve when taking on a role. Without De Niro's performance, we don't have Benicio del Toro, Christian Bale, Sean Penn, DiCaprio, none of them. Next time you see Denzel, ask him what he thinks about Raging Bull. I guarantee you, he'll sit you down and have a moment with you about it. Round two, the opening credits. This sequence, which is shot in a still frame over opera music, lets you know you're in for something huge. It's a painting. It's the Sistine Chapel of opening sequences. De Niro dancing around the ring in slow motion sets the tone like no opening sequence before or since. Round three, Joe Pesci. This was Joe Pesci's first part in a legitimate film. He was vivaciously alive, vulnerable, real, and brought straight-face humor and pain as LaMotta's brother Joey. Of course, Pesci went on to become one of the world's most beloved actors. He was nominated for Best Supporting Actor in Raging Bull and wound up losing to Timothy Hutton in Ordinary People. The first time I ever got drunk in my life was on the set of a movie I did called Beautiful Girls, and I let Timothy Hutton know how I felt about him beating Joe Pesci for the statue in 1980. Needless to say, it didn't go well. But Raging Bull introduced the world to Joe Pesci. Number four, the TV show Cheers. Remember the guy who played Coach on Cheers? He was a journeyman actor named Nicholas Colestano, whose biggest break before Cheers was playing Tommy Cuomo, the mob boss who pushes Jake LaMotta to throw the fight. He actually passed away during the third season of Cheers and was replaced by then unknown actor Woody Harrelson. No Raging Bull, no Woody Harrelson, which means no white man can't jump. You're welcome again. Number five, Kathy Moriarty. Her raspy voice alone should have gotten her an award. The first time she appears in the film kicking her legs in the pool, stunning like a 50s pinup girl, is one of the greatest introductions to any character in film history. This is arguably one of the sexiest sports film performances, along with those of Susan Sarandon and Bull Durham, Rosario Dawson and He Got Game, and Rosie Perez and White Man Can't Jump. Round six, humor. Even though Raging Bull is emotionally dark, it's also funny as fuck. And the humor comes from Pesci and De Niro arguing over the most basic of life things. They're like some sort of violent Laurel and Hardy. The hit me in the face scene is like the Abbott and Costello Who's on First classic. Joey trying to tell Jake to get into a fight by explaining, if you win, you win. If you lose, you still win. Just get down to 155 pounds, you fat bastard. You understand everything. You don't understand that. Makes no sense and complete sense at the same time. Raging Bull pulls off humor where it seemed impossible. Round seven, John Turturro. One of the most underrated actors of the last 25 years, he auditioned over and over to be a part of Raging Bull, knowing it was going to be something special. A young John Turturro wound up having just a single line in the film, but got to sit at the table with Robert De Niro and Joe Pesci in one of the key scenes at the Copacabana. You can see him at the 22-minute and 15-second mark of the movie. Round eight, cinematography. Every ounce of the black and white cinematography is perfection. Shot by Michael Chapman, the boxing scenes are so seamlessly put together that it's hard to make sense of when they start and when they end. The boxing in the movie is a choreographed dance of beauty and violence. The fight scenes are shot like horror films, and the brutality and violence are felt through the camera. One of the most memorable shots in film history is the blood on the rope shot at 1 hour, 41 minutes, and 21 seconds into the film. That shot single-handedly articulates everything that is violent about the sweet science of boxing. You can literally watch that movie with no sound and witness pure art in cinematography. Number nine, Boogie Nights. Paul Thomas Anderson, the director of Boogie Nights, borrowed so many moments and ideas from Raging Bull and Martin Scorsese to make his classic porn tale that he could have named it Boogie Bull. From the close-ups to the old-fashioned camera flashes, to the long steady shots, to the most obvious final scene in Boogie Nights when Dirk, played by Mark Wahlberg, sits in front of the mirror, goes over his lines, and then whips out his prosthetic piece. That scene is lifted almost shot for shot and verbatim from Raging Bull's final scene. Round 10, life lessons. You never got me down, Ray. I never went down. There are so many life lessons in this film that inspire me to this day. Jake tells his wife after losing a controversial 15-round decision, the people knew, they knew, they knew who the boss was. The judges didn't know. Who knows what happened with them? But the people knew. I find this dialogue so inspiring. This is something I say to myself when I'm feeling underappreciated, misunderstood, or taken for granted. I say to myself, the people know what you're about, Mike. The people get you. Producers, agents, nerds, and judgmental hipster fucks want to pass judgment. They don't want to give you a shot. They don't want to figure you out. Well, fuck them. The people get you. The people know. They know. Try it. Next time you're feeling like you're not being heard or appreciated, ask yourself if the people know what you're all about. And if the answer is yes, trust me, you'll start to feel a little better. Fuck the judges. The credit goes to those in the ring. There are so many Raging Bull pick-me-up lines, I'm surprised they haven't released a book of haikus from the psyche of Jake LaMotta. Round 11. You fuck my wife? A classic yet shocking line that goes down in the annals of history as one of cinema's greatest pieces of dialogue. You build it, they will come. That's meaningful. That's great. The janitor's speech to Rudy will pull you out of a dark funk. But Jake LaMotta asking his brother Joey if he fucked his life is a moment you can never forget. The danger and dysfunction of that scene and that line is beyond any sports film moment. Round 12, editing. This was the start of an incredible partnership between Martin Scorsese and his film editor, Thelma Schoonmaker. And she has cut and pieced together every Scorsese film since. They are like the Joe Montana and Jerry Rice of filmmaking. Round 13, get your shine box. Frank Vincent. You know Frank Vincent, even if you don't know his name. He's the shiny, gray-haired, raspy-voiced guy from almost every mafia film and TV show in the last 30 years. He's the guy who infamously tells Joe Pesci to go get your fucking shine box in the movie Goodfellas. Well, Frank made his debut in Raging Bull, and he's the kind of actor that's so real, you think he's just being himself. Round 14, Martin Scorsese. I got to interview Martin Scorsese about Raging Bull. And if you listen to the interview, I sound like I'm floating in outer space the entire time because I couldn't even believe it was happening. He told me a bunch of things, but this golden nugget I will never forget as long as I live. He said, I took everything I knew, everything I had, and put it into that film. I put everything on the line, my money, my health, everything. That film was everything I was looking for. For me, it was about finding my soul again. Martin Scorsese cemented himself as a true artistic genius after Raging Bull. He went as deep as he could to reclaim his soul, and you could feel it in every beat, every moment on the screen. Round 15, the 1980s. Raging Bull was nominated for 6 Academy Awards in 1980. It wound up losing Best Picture to Ordinary People. But in perfect poetic justice, after 10 years, all of the most respected film critics in the industry took a vote on the best film of the 80s, and Raging Bull won by a landslide. No sports film has ever been voted best film of an entire decade. It never happened. The people knew. They knew. Caitlin, Caitlin, Caitlin. Don't get me wrong. I've been a fan of Bruce Jenner since that dude won the decathlon in the 1976 Olympics. The shot put, the javelin, sprinting, high jumping, winning it all with Marlboro Man chest hair. That shit makes you one of the greatest athletes of all time, hands down. I mean, I was only 6, but I was ready to grow some chest hair after watching that man run for gold. Bruce is on the cover of Wheaties and Playgirl. Two covers that don't have shit to do with each other, but that's how insanely popular he was at that time. He was one of the most famous people on the planet. Came from nothing and made something of himself. Bruce was married, making only $9,000 a year while his first wife was supporting him, and he was training his ass off in his spare time. After competing, he was writing books, racing cars, and making money. Bruce Jenner was a corporation. And then it happened. He got mixed up with the Kardashians, ended up on that show, and it all went fucking south. Didn't you get the memo, bro? You go into that house a man, and you come out all fucked up. I don't know what sort of voodoo pussy is happening over there, but no one is safe, especially not a man. Check the records. It hasn't been pretty for any of them. Lamar Odom goes in a first-round draft pick NBA superstar with amazing potential and comes out hanging on for dear life after overdosing on crack cocaine, fuck pills, and white girls in a whorehouse in Nevada. That was an epic downfall of sad proportions. Then you got my little man Ray J, who starts out with a promising career, sleeps with Kim on camera, dives into that legendary Apple ass, and never makes a good track again. The dude got the snapper and lost his voice. Where's the voice? Check the snapper. And is there a fucking recording studio in her ass? I have no fucking clue. I'm just calling it like I see it. Then Kanye West, one of the best beat makers and rappers in the game, goes in and 2 years later he's crying on stage and referring to himself in the third person. What the fuck part of the movie Get Out didn't you get? And shit, I'm not even blaming them for everything. Look, I know you're confused, Caitlin. You said it many times. You said you felt like a girl growing up and you had female feelings. I get it. I'm confused every day of my life. But it's the way that you're fucking going about it now that you're Caitlin. I'm not a fan. And it has absolutely nothing to do with you being transgender. That might be my favorite thing about you. Someone wants to be what they feel deep inside and wants to transition? Then guess what? I'm all for it. Come out. Let's go. I'll hold your hand and throw on some heels for the fuck of it. Listen, I grew up in Manhattan in the 1970s. I saw it all and I didn't discriminate. I walked out of my apartment on the Upper East Side of Manhattan and said, "What's up, Jeannie?" every single morning to a giant transgender woman that hung out on a stoop every day on my block. I did it like it was nothing and went about my day. That shit didn't bother me at all. Never has, never will. But there is something I'm just not feeling about you, Caitlin, and I think I know what it is. You should not be the face and the voice of the trans community. And I don't think I'm alone here in my thinking. As a matter of fact, I know I'm not alone. Anyone who lives in Hollywood, California knows that Yum Yum Donuts is a great hang for the trans community. And when I'm getting my coffee and donut game on, we talk. And they ain't happy either. These Hollywood streets are talking, Caitlin. You really think that you represent what they've been dealing with for most of their lives? You got $50 million in the bank from that fucked up TV show, and now you're the self-anointed voice of the transgender people? Yeah, you may have started with little, but you've led a privileged life for the last 30 years. Many of these people have been ostracized, beat up, left for dead in the streets, addicted to drugs, and all other types of bullshit, and you're wearing Manolo Blahnik shoes and a $6,000 orange dress popping up on Diane Sawyer talking about you voted for Donald Trump? I don't think you represent them at all, girl. You're with Trump, and you think you're representing the LGBT community? You ain't clear on how Trump and his crew feel about the LGBT community? You're on national TV talking about not regretting that you voted for Donald fucking Trump? Donald Trump doesn't give a shit about proven scientific facts. You think he gives a fuck about you? No, we got a problem here, my friend. Where the hell is your head at? I know where it is. It's in your bank with all your money, isn't it? You know if Trump could, he would lock you in the closet and never let you out? That's the guy you're voting for? The guy said that people can't use the bathroom they identify with. The guy opposes nationwide same-sex marriage. And this is your guy? Who the fuck are you fighting for? The LGBT transgender community or the wealthy, rich, white motherfuckers that keep your money safe? Because it can't be both, my friend. Think it over, Caitlin, before they turn on you. And let's just be honest, you're just not that exciting to watch on TV to begin with. Yeah, I said it. Maybe you're just not that interesting. If you're on the number one reality show in the world as a famous man, and then you're transitioning into an even more famous woman, and your own spin-off show gets canceled, guess what? You're fucking boring, Caitlin. Once again, I am not here to bash your choices, and I am damn sure not here to bash your community, but I am here to let you know that it's offensive to the people in the struggle when you're popping up as the public face of transgender with $24,000 worth of gold on your neck, and you're voting for that fuckface Donald Trump who can't stand you. And on a side note, you claim to have known that O.J. Simpson was guilty and you kept it to yourself? Yeah, I read that article also. I read all about it. You told my man Andy Cohen that you and Robert Kardashian both knew that fucking guy was a murderer and you didn't say shit about it? Get with the fucking program, homegirl. Listen, come get some coffee and donuts with me and the good folks at Yum Yum Donuts sometime. People want to talk to you. Stickmen, the ultimate list of great stickmen, part one. I was lucky enough to work with Sylvester Stallone on the great ensemble film Copland. I knew when I got the part I was going to fan out on Stallone, but I tried to keep it all in check. I mean, Rocky is one of the reasons why I ever considered becoming an actor. I'm not joking. I saw that movie, I ran outside, and I challenged every single kid on the Upper East Side for a fight, and then decided to become an actor. That movie literally changed my life. Now, I don't trip out on a lot of people, but here was one of my idols in life. On the first day of shooting, I spotted him alone, smoking off to the side, enjoying his peace and his quiet. First of all, the fact that he was smoking a cigarette threw me the fuck off. John fucking Rambo doesn't smoke cigarettes, does he? So instead of leaving him in peace to enjoy his smoke break, I walked right up to him and told him how much Rocky inspired me. He could tell I wasn't joking around, and he was cool as shit about it. I threw a few Rocky lines at him, and I'm telling you the God's honest truth, Sylvester Stallone started coming right back at me with the next line in the movie. I was tripping out. All of a sudden, me and Sly are straight up doing scenes from all the Rockies. I was Paulie, he was Apollo. I was Adrian, he was Rocky. I hit him with some Mickey lines, and he came right back at me with actual Rocky lines. It was unreal. It was a dream come true until the director came over and said, Michael, you have to stop talking to Sly about Rocky, man. We're shooting Copland here. So I had to quit distracting him. But before I left Sly alone, he dropped some shit on me that I will never forget. I asked him about Burgess Meredith, the legendary actor who played Mickey in all the Rocky films. And without missing a beat, he tells me, oh, not only was Burgess an amazing actor, but he was a real stick man. I said, what? Stallone says, oh yeah, that man was great with the ladies. He was a notorious cocksman, one of the best of all time. I was stunned. Seriously? The little old guy from Grumpy Old Men was a world-class stick man? A cocksman? I had to recalibrate my whole thought process. I mean, I had heard about Warren Beatty in his day, and of course, I heard about Elvis and the ladies, but Burgess Meredith? What the hell was I going to hear next? Did Abe Vigoda have his loaf out on the set of The Godfather? But Stallone was dead-ass serious. As it turns out, Burgess Meredith was a world-class stickman. So, in honor of all the great stickmen out there, here is the completely fact-checked yet absolutely based on nothing guaranteed, not real, of the greatest stickmen of all time. Webster and Michael Rapaport's definition of a stickman. A man with the innate, God-given ability to bed down many, many women while having none of them speak poorly of him and continue on with his blessed, wonderful life of sleeping around with no strings attached or regrettable repercussions. Now let me be clear here. There is a huge difference between a stick man and an irresponsible scumbag. Anyone can use fame to pull out the loaf and drop it on a stranger's table and roll the dice, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about that Donald Trump grab him by the pussy shitbag talk. That's scumbum bush league bullshit. That's the shit that people say when the only way to get laid is by paying for it or owning a building that they don't really own. No. I'm talking about a gentleman who does what he does and no one gets hurt. Women don't bash him or slam him to their friends. I'm talking about a man that does his thing and gets street compliments and receives wonderful praise in certain circles. I'm talking about the All-Stickman League of America. And I'm only dealing with America here because I don't feel like going into Latin American bullfighters, European soccer players, or any of that Australian rugby shit. They can make their own list. This is ours. Good old American Stickman. Let's begin. Prince and his purple loaf. Prince was a world-class tiny purple stick man. Prince was the eighth wonder of the world. He was 4'7", wore high heels, was better looking than most women in makeup, could still do splits when he was 50, and ran the shit like the mini pimp of Minneapolis. Prince was pulling out the velvet loaf and laying down high-level game for years. He had white, black, Asian, all mixes, all races, all religions, orgy shit on lockdown. Prince's bedroom looked like an orphanage full of beautiful female adults and sometimes animals. Who the hell knows what was going on in there? Prince had a velvet rope in front of his bed. He had Apollonia and Vanity all in the same decade, the same movie, and in the same city. Have you ever been to Minneapolis? Do you have any idea how tight your high heel guitar game must be to lock down 2-10s in a city that lives in the snow? You have any idea how tight your game has to be to wear long, flowing dresses, black fishnet stockings, high heels, and a painted-on mustache and lay it down like Prince did? Motherfucking Prince was crossing borders before the shit was okay to do, and he wasn't afraid of big women either. Prince showed up with Kirstie Alley at an award show in the 80s, and she was carrying him like a fucking baby. He didn't give a fuck, and neither do I. He once rolled into the Grammys with two models and a baby blanket around his neck. Prince recorded a stick session with Kim Basinger in her prime, and her moans made it onto the Batman soundtrack. Are you hearing what I'm saying? He put her moans on one of the biggest grossing film soundtracks of all time. That's right. Basinger's getting the Raspberry Beret, Peter Piper picked the Pepper Pussy treatment, and she was so happy with my man, she let him put it on a record. Did she have a hard time getting another acting job? I don't know. I'm not here to discuss acting careers. The point is Prince had it all on lock, and he is a first ballot stick man hands down. Prince had a don't talk, just walk next to me and look straight ahead and nod rule with women. So R.I.P. to Prince and R.I.P. to his purple loaf. He's one of the greats, and I am proud to acknowledge him here at the top of the list. Derek Jeter. He's sometime referred to as your favorite stickman's favorite stickman. I gotta talk about my man Derek Jeter, because he kept his shit low and we knew what was happening. Yeah, that's right, Derek. We read it in the papers, we saw it in the New York Post, we know you had shit popping, but you never talked about it in public, and that is a true prerequisite for a gifted stickman. And you did it in the greatest sports market in the world. No, this wasn't some small town smash and grab shit. This was New York City, where everyone knows everything and they follow you around all day, every day, and no one knew where the fuck you were, and then you just pop up on a street corner with a beautiful 5'11" brunette fresh off the boat from Brazil sent to America to model her feet, and no one hated you for it. We loved you. You did it all under the radar and incognito. We respected that. You weren't on that A-Rod, clip Madonna, get some press, send some pictures back home to show off to your boys type of fame shit. No, you, Derek Jeter, were a gentleman. Well-raised by good parents in Kalamazoo, Michigan, dreaming of a better life in the big leagues, and hoping one day to put up Hall of Fame stats on and off the field. Well, you did, Derek. You did it big. I know people, okay? I'm from New York. It's my town. I hear shit, okay? I'm in the streets. I don't read rag magazines or get my info from TMZ. And I hear the shit they talk about in pizza spots and back alley entrances to nightclubs. Yeah, I know about you, and I like it all. and you had the ability to keep high-profile chicks low. That's a great gift that's not talked about much. You, my friend, had the skill of a world-class stick man. You handled Mariah Carey in her prime like she never even had a song out. You know how tough that is? You had her on lock like you went to high school with her. She's out there now in the nudes taking dudes' money just for dating them, and you had her on platinum selling lockdown. That's real high-quality stickman shit right there. And you didn't brag about it or put women on your arm to parade them around everywhere. You did it all, like a gentleman. And you didn't judge either, Derek. Now, you sometimes had women that I would never even call back myself. That's right. You let your small-town roots bloom and made them all feel like they had a shot. Sure, you freaked off with pop stars, actresses, and models, but you, my friend, were not afraid to windsprint your way into a cleaning lady just to let a motherfucker know that you were from Kalamazoo. You didn't come out here and go all Hollywood with it. You were a man of the people, and everyone got treated nicely. And that is what I like to hear. Rumors were floating around that post-coital women got gift baskets. You bring a woman in, you put on some music, you take out the loaf, make magical things happen, and then you hand out t-shirts, hats, and signed baseballs when it's over. That's real shit, Derek. You are a multi-purpose Hall of Famer. Thanks for the memories. Now congratulations with your marriage and your new family. Sincerely. Dominique Wilkins. Dominique Wilkins was known as the human highlight film both on the floor and in the bedroom. Dominique spent the 80s and 90s flying through the air, slam dunking on every dime piece in sight. We know, man, the respect was earned, not given. When people discuss your sexual prowess almost 17 years after you're out of the league, we know some real shit went down. There is women in Atlanta right now in their late 40s and early 50s who still have your picture in the living room hanging next to family photos. I know these things. Please trust me here. I don't name names and I never reveal my sources, but let's just say since my foray into the sporting world, your name has come up many, many times when it comes to fantastic stickmen who handled entire regions. That's right. It wasn't just Atlanta. Dominique Wilkins had the entire Southeast on lockdown, and Dominique kept it scandal-free and gentleman-heavy, which I must repeat is the sign of a true stickman. Dominique scored a perfect 10 in the dunk contest and a perfect 10 at the after party. That's right. That's what he did. So I don't want to hear shit from any of you new-school dudes on Snapchat and Insta-dick pic. I'm talking about the old-school, old-fashioned shit where you have to have real charisma and charm coming off that visitor's bus after a hard-fought game in Utah. Dominique, we miss your style, man. Next up, Jack Nicholson. We don't have this chapter without talking about Jack Nicholson. The Joker's game was no joke. Jack's stickman status was solidified in the late 60s and throughout the 70s, and the streets are still fucking reeling. Right now, at age 80, Jack keeps four girls in the second row at every Laker game that are there to possibly join him for a late-night milkshake and a swim, just for old time's sakes. Jack Nicholson is a fucking legend. And yeah, I could have researched even older, old-school legends and gone over what was happening in the days of Sir Lawrence Olivier and Clark Gable. Of course. And why the fuck would I do that? And listen, I'm not writing a history book here. I'm making a list. And Jack Nicholson's mythology was building at a time we still hear about to this day. A time when the Playboy Mansion was going off and the Hollywood Free Your Mind sexcapades were going down like never before. Nicholson was unfolding the loaf at the Playboy Mansion next to the monkey cage, and nobody was saying shit. He had the grotto on lock, and they brought him hors d'oeuvres. And personally, I don't think it's over. Jack is in his 80s handling the game like a professional gentleman. And he did it with pure charm. Let's face it, Jack's not the best-looking leading man of all time. It's not like he was walking around with George Clooney's bone structure or Channing Tatum's shoulders. He don't give a fuck. He's Jack, and that is what separates the greats from the pack. to raise your stick game to nearly the same height as your acting game? That is amazing, not to mention exhausting. I'm tired just thinking about how late and deep into the dark nights Jack was going. And once again, like many a man before him, Nicholson was doing it pre-internet. Oh yeah, there was no members-only dating apps making shit easy back then. No, this was straight-up indoor, low-pro, true-to-the-art stick game shit. And you'll never see any cock shots from the Joker. He didn't need them. This was when cocaine and pool parties were happening on Monday mornings. This ain't no Justin Bieber ass naked on a yacht shit. Jack didn't need a yacht. He just needed a room. This is all in the heyday of the sexual revolution, and Jack played it low-key and subtle. He dated Kelly LeBrock, okay? This is public knowledge. I'm not dropping some inside narc shit here. Yo, Kelly LeBrock was so fine, they made a movie about the perfect woman built by geeks, and she played her. Jack was getting fictional robot pussy before Austin Powers ever hit the theater circuit. Ah, those were the days. I'm sure there were many nights when he and my main man, Burgess Meredith, just nodded at each other from across the room at the Playboy Mansion. Wilt Chamberlain. They called him the Stilt. Obvious or not, he's here. No first ballot Hall of Fame stick man has had his conquest so openly disputed, discussed, or scrutinized as the Big Dipper. Despite it all, his scoring records on and off the court have yet to be broken, and he stood by his claims until the day he died. The number is 20,000. The man vehemently stood by the number of 20,000 sexual encounters. 20,000 women in his lifetime, and you know what? Not one of them was married. This is 100% a rumor and not fact-checked, but it was from Wilt Chamberlain's mouth, and he stuck by that story, and I have no reason not to believe him, and it's too late to ask. Now look, I don't even know if there are 20,000 unmarried women on the planet, but he says that there were. The man had over 31,000 points and the infamous 100-point game and averaged 50 points a game in one season, all while laying some mean pipe down across the United States of America. One misconception about Wilt was that he bragged about his fuck game. He never bragged about his personal conquests. People were asking him, and he just answered, honestly, like a gentleman. He wasn't trying to prove anything. He was just putting it out there for people that were curious. Well, guess what, Wilt? We were all fucking curious. I had my guy Ira run some numbers and do some math because I don't have that kind of time. And here's what he came up with. Wilt Chamberlain would have had to sleep with 500 women a year for 40 years straight to put up those kinds of numbers. And he would have had to have a few years of 750 women plus to make it happen. But Wilt, either way, I give it to you, my man. You did what you did, and the women never came back to sue or complain. They just remembered a good time with a good man and a great athlete. They don't make them like the Stilt anymore. So rest in peace, big fella. You have to be exhausted. Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein, better known to some as Albert Einstick. Listen up, all you four-eyed, nerdy A students out there. Your hero was also a great stick man. Married twice with at least six girlfriends during his second marriage, Big Al was working on the theory of pimping before he ever thought about the theory of relativity. The man figured out long geometry during marathon threesomes. His brain and his loaf searched for answers to the world's toughest scientific questions and found them in bed with strangers. Albert Einstein was fucking wild. He made up a list of do's and don'ts for his first wife, including she would cook, clean, and feed him with no guarantee that he would return any such feelings, and then he made out with his cousin in public. While his brain was hyper-evolved, his sex drive was in the animal kingdom. Listen, I don't condone marrying your cousin or cheating on your wife while living with a gang of mistresses, but I will be damned if I'm not putting this legend right where he belongs. Besides, he deserves some slack. The guy must have been stressed the fuck out. And you try figuring out mass energy equivalence or the theory of relativity and the random movement of particles and see if you don't need an outlet to release some anxiety from your brain. R.I.P. Mr. Einsticker. Your work and your legacy still live on. And finally, Leo.